Welcome to A Christian and a Buddhist Walk Into a Bar. My name is Jamal and I'm a Buddhist.
I'm Jacob and I am a Christian.
And I am sounding like I am speaking underwater today.
That's because I put a goldfish bowl on top of your head.
It's true. It's true. My name is Jamal and I'm a goldfish.
Excellent. He's got the memo, ladies and gentlemen. Do goldfish pray?
Welcome to A Christian and a Buddhist Walk Into a Bar. My name is Jamal and I'm a goldfish.
My name's Jacob. And I'm a piranha.
Welcome to a Christian. Sorry, I'll do the 3 second memory thing.
Yeah, I see it.
Forgot under the intro.
Did goldfish pray? I'll ask it another way. Do you ever pray, Jamal?
Do I ever pray?
Yeah.
No. But not definitively no.
That sounds like maybe. Can you pray without knowing? Define pray. I would say that pray is in some form or other a conversation with the divine or speaking words in the direction of the divine. I'll put it that way. I'm not sure if the author of today's article would agree with that definition, but that's how I'd go.
In that case, then no.
Okay.
I don't really believe that you can speak to the divine. The divine is to be observed and not spoken to. It's not going to speak back.
I have a friend who teaches religious education in a Christian school who describes prayer like, you know, when they have prayer time in class, says, well, you can pray, and if that's not really a thing, you can just send good vibes out into the universe.
Right, yeah.
So maybe that's a better Buddhist definition of prayer, perhaps.
I think about meditation or even about the rituals of Buddhism, you know, the two things you're doing there in meditation, it's about observation and about reflection and observing yourself and the world.
And so even, not directed towards the divine in any way.
Right. Yeah. Directed towards looking at the divine, but not talking to the divine. And even the chanting and the rituals and, you know, all that kind of stuff, that's about essentially reinforcing messages to yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, so the chant might literally say, you know, I worship the Buddha and I worship the whatever else. But you're not saying that because the Buddha's sitting there listening going, thank you for that worship. You're saying that because you are reminding yourself about how you're engaging with the practice and what you want to be doing, that kind of thing.
That raises almost immediately we go off on a bit of a tangent because that makes me a little bit curious about Islamic prayer. And I don't know how much you know about Islamic prayer.
Not a whole lot, yeah.
Islamic prayer, in my experience, is very kind of like rote. It's you pray this prayer at this particular time, and it's in Arabic, and it's all kind of exactly as it was dictated. And so it does seem, in some sense, that it's less directed at God as forming those kind of like it is directed at God, obviously.
Yeah.
But it's also forming those habits and patterns and kind of affecting the way that you see the world. And I would say prayer does that, but kind of as a byproduct, I guess.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, maybe Islamic prayer is trying to do both, right? Maybe it's forming habits and patterns, but also, you know, exhorting God in the same breath.
Which is not that different to like Christian monastic prayer or praying a psalm or something like that. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. So, well, you said we have an article today. What article have you got for us?
So we've got an article called "You Don't Have to Follow a Particular God to Say a Prayer. The Words Are All That Matter" by Jackie Bailey on The Guardian.
Your favourite.
My fave. She writes interesting articles from a kind of post-Christian perspective that I think are good to engage with. And from the sounds of things, you would agree with that headline, I guess, that the words are all that matter.
Because it depends what you think they're doing, right? I without knowing when she says all that matters, what is she trying to achieve or what is the purpose of the prayer? But yeah, sure. If the purpose of the prayer is to verbalize a kind of an intention or a kind of focus on something, yes, sure.
Well, and that's kind of the starting off point, right? The psychological research has shown that people tend to feel happier as a result of some particular types of prayer,
right?
So, and that's, I've come across this in Christian circles as well, right? Like that there are studies that show that kind of prayer is good for your sort of mental health, your being in the world, or like basically regardless of which religious practice you follow. It seems that prayer is a good thing. It lowers your blood pressure and does a whole bunch of other good stuff.
Right. But yeah. I guess my question is the point of prayer to have physical health benefits for you?
Well, this is why the article put me offside early on by suggesting this, right? Because, like, I can kind of, like, if that's your gateway into prayer and then you kind of come to know God through that and whatever, awesome, great. But I don't think that's actually the purpose of prayer. It's about, well, and maybe that's, again, where a Christian and a Buddhist disagreement would happen, right? Because I would say that prayer is not, like, your well-being will be better if you pray, but that's because you're connected with God, right? That's because of the point of it. But having said that, the studies don't show that, or if they do show that, they show that kind of God shows up in a whole bunch of forms and it doesn't make a difference which one of those forms you pray to.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, which to me kind of gets that thing of, like, you know, I don't know. I think when I think of prayer, I've always thought about it as the idea that, like, you know, it's about your connection with God. It's not about what it does for you.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And that's, I would say this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I guess this article maybe takes a different premise, which is the idea that prayer can be really useful and have a lot of kind of real life benefits, irrespective of what's actually going on spiritually.
Well, a certain type of prayer, and this was a part that I found really interesting. Like, so she talks about conversational prayers, prayers of adoration and thanks, or a prayerful attitude of opening oneself up with the divine sense of mystery. And so you'd be happy to hear that she describes her own version of the Buddhist metta. May I be at ease, may I be of service, may I be well, may I be happy, may I be safe. That's a kind of prayer habit for this writer. But that seems to have a bit of a connection with, like, awe that we were talking about a couple of months ago now.
Yeah.
But this sense of the majesty of everything and the smallness of me, it seems like that's describing a similar phenomenon. Whereas if we go down to the end of that paragraph, by contrast, some studies suggest ritual prayers and petitionary prayers. So ritual prayers being the kind of repetitive, and petitionary prayers being, you know, actually praying for something, have been related to increased depression and tension.
Right.
Now, I haven't clicked on the link and it says some studies, so I'm not sure kind of what depth of research has gone into that. But that was a bit that I found really interesting, because kind of leaving aside the difference of what's a difference between a conversational prayer and a petitionary prayer, for a lot of Christians, I think a lot of the time, petitionary prayers are the prayers that we most go to. And for people I know who don't pray that often, when they do pray, it tends to be related to something. We heard this after the bushfires in 2020, right? Like, a whole heap of people saying, well, I've never prayed before, but I was praying right now, right? Like, yeah.
Yeah, well, and again, I think this goes to the core tenet and maybe the core disagreement you have with this article, right, which is, what is the purpose of prayer? Because I can totally accept this whole thing if we're talking about, and this is a very liberal humanist view, and shock horror, it's The Guardian, they're liberal humanist. But, like, you know, the view that human experience is the most important thing. So essentially the argument there goes, well, whatever improves your experience is good. Yeah. And so therefore holding on to a level of religiosity, prayer, this kind of thing, if it helps support you get through hard times or you understand things or decrease your blood pressure or any of those things, that's a great thing to do, irrespective. Yeah, it's like the truth doesn't matter.
Yeah.
The human experience that is the result of a thing is the thing that matters, right?
Which is essentially the truth of humanism, right?
Right.
Like the human experience is all that there is, and so anything that enhances that, we could go into hedonism another day.
Right, but yeah. But yeah, so, and I guess maybe the difference here, if you're disagreeing with that, is this idea that, well, no, you think that the truth of God or the genuine connection with actual spiritual deity is more important than any human impact that connection might bring. The human impact is a secondary after effect of the actual connection.
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair way to say it. I wouldn't say that the human impact kind of doesn't matter,
right?
Because it does.
Well, I mean, it matters, but not as much.
Yeah, and a side effect is a good way to put it.
Yeah. Right, yeah, okay. I mean, I get that. I think that probably, it's interesting. I think Buddhism, again, this actually links very closely into the conversation we're having last week around... Around, you know, pure theology and practical theology, right? I think from Buddhism's perspective, I think if you're engaging in that sila layer, if you're talking about the kind of the ethical foundation of living well, then it almost goes to the humanist side. It says, well, kind of like, you know, do whatever you want to do to actually help you do that, right? So that that kind of the ritualistic stuff that comes in there in Buddhism is really useful for that purpose. But then, yeah, as soon as you cross over into the more kind of purely theological punya area, then suddenly it's like, well, you know, all of that kind of doesn't matter, and actually, you know, there's a greater kind of that. And rather than saying, well, you should still pray, but you should just do it in this way, it just says, we'll just drop the prayer thing altogether. I mean, again, monks...
kind of advance beyond what you needed to do to get to this step.
Right. Well, and don't get me wrong, monks still very much do lots of chanting. There are hours and hours of chanting that monks do every single day. Like, I would say on average, a monk would chant 2 hours a day.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that. And again, so maybe that's a little bit of a misnomer there, right? It's not... let go of what you did to take you to this step. You have to keep up what you did to get you to this step, because otherwise you'll lose the step.
But you have to know that it doesn't matter. Ultimately, that's where you land.
What it's doing is, you know, it's... I think last week you spoke about how, like, you know, you've climbed the ladder, then you realize the ladder is translucent, right?
Yeah.
It's like you still need the ladder even if it's translucent. That you know, if you fully actually turn around and the ladder's invisible and, you know, gone, then you'll just fall back down.
Yeah, it's one thing for it to be invisible. It's another thing for it to not be there.
Right. So you still actually need it there, and you still need to do the maintenance to make sure it stays there. But that's the point is not the ladder. The point is the thing you're reaching with the ladder.
Yeah, no, yeah. That makes sense. And I guess in a similar way, like there's not, like the point of prayer, I would say, is kind of, well, is it? I was going to say the point of prayer is prayer in and of itself, but it's where it's directed. Because if it was prayer in and of itself, then we'd be back where we started and it wouldn't matter. And it was as long as you said the right words. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that probably gets to, like, again, my other, the other thing I found challenging here, shall we say. She writes, the theologian Caspar Ter Kuile, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, suggests replacing the phrase Our Father in the Christian Lord's Prayer with other nouns such as Mother Wolf or Sister Pigeon. In this way, I might still access a deep familiarity of this prayer while remembering that God is in everything, everywhere. And it's, to me, when you get to that point, it's like, yeah, you've missed the point of the prayer now. And again, if that works for you, that's fine. But well, Sister Pigeon is not actually God,
and I think that's interesting, right? Because here's an interesting psychological layer, right? Let's take the premise of this article at face value and say that is true, right? That actually what's important here is the liberal humanist experience of things, right? I would fathom that there's a few layers to that research which says that actually prayer is good for you irrespective of what the truth is, right?
Right.
I think a few layers to that, I would assume, not having read the research, I would assume that what they're saying here is prayer acts as a placebo, right? Prayer acts as a psychological placebo for a number of different things. And we know from science that placebos work.
Sure.
But placebos absolutely work. Now, a few things we know about placebos working. One, we know that placebos work on a scale of what the placebo you're taking is. So a pill placebo is not as effective as an injection placebo, right? So I inject you with saline or you take a salt pill.
The injection's going to have the stronger effect.
Because
you expect that to be a stronger medicine.
Correct, yeah. Right. Even if they're both still placebos, right?
Sure.
Also, placebo works even if you don't believe it, but it does work more if you do believe it, right?
Yeah.
There is still a statistically significant effect of the placebo if you know that it is a placebo, but it is more effective if you don't know that it's a placebo, right?
Right.
And so I would say that if prayer is a placebo, if what this article is that all this stuff has benefits, whatever else, then I would say a few things. I would say that prayer works better if it feels more genuine and strongly connected. So saying our Father who art in heaven is stronger than saying our Mother Wolf who art in heaven, mm-hmm. because the person who's saying that, I'm going to assume, has some...
Like social, if you're a druid, it might be a different thing.
Right, but, right? Yeah. But they've got some social childhood connection to saying that prayer. And so somewhere in the back of their mind, that's a more legitimate and serious thing to say yep. than Mother Wolf, right?
Sure.
So I think the... And because you associate it with a real religion that's big and whatever else, like, yeah, I think it becomes a... You know, and for example, I would argue that, you know, someone growing up in the Middle East, the same would be true, but they should do Arabic prayers,
sure.
not Christian prayers, yeah, yeah. right? Because that has the connection to their own cultural
It's the childhood depth of like, right. Well, if there is a God, then this is how we talk to said God.
Right, yeah. Right, yeah. So Muslim prayers are more effective. Sorry, I said Arabic prayers before, but Muslim prayers are more effective in that scenario because that's the context you sure. know, and that's something that feels more yep. legitimate to you. Yep.
Unless you've had a conversion to Christianity or...
But the point is it's got to feel
Sikhism
legitimate.
Sikhism or whatever. Right? Yeah. Exactly, yeah, yeah.
So whatever is the most legitimate feeling of prayer for you is the most yep. effective one. So there's that layer to it too. But also, if you believe it, it's probably going to be more likely. So I would hazard that a Christian who prays has greater impacts of that prayer than a non-Christian who prays, even if they're doing what they're saying here and just praying for the sake of actually mm-hmm. getting the placebo effect.
Mm-hmm. Which kind of like brings us back in a way full circle to like what do you expect out of a prayer, right? Because if you're just doing it to like to feel good about things or just to jump into secular prayer for a moment, I listened to an episode ages ago, sometime last year, on the podcast No Such Thing as a Fish,
yeah.
which is a wonderful podcast where Dan Schreiber, not a Christian, was saying that he'd been getting into praying because he reckoned, like, when else do you just stop and call to mind family members and loved ones? And so kind of like, why not pray for them for that
right.
purpose? Which, like, is a kind of, like, that's a cool way of using prayer, I guess. Like, I guess I probably have a bit more sympathy with that than to, like, for your own wellness. Maybe that's a bit, it's probably a bit harsh of me. I'm being a bit hypocritical. A little bit, I apologize yeah, yeah. for this. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But like, because if you go into a prayer for something other than the meditative state with the expectation that God might actually respond to this prayer, then you're stuck with a problem if God doesn't, or if God doesn't in the way that you expect God to, right? Like, so it's kind of the more onto the belief end of the spectrum you are, depending on the kind of prayers you're praying, but definitely in a Christian context, the more down the belief end of the spectrum you get, the kind of harder it is in some way as well, because you have a level of expectation.
Yeah, for sure.
On the prayer. Yeah.
No, I totally get that, right? And yeah, so I guess here's an interesting thing. Does the argument follow that if what we're saying is, well, it's still good to pray even if you don't believe in God, that even if you don't believe in God, it's better to believe in God?
I think that's what we're saying.
Yeah. Right, because if you want to take that argument to the extreme, then even if you don't believe in God... Well, if we're saying that the placebo benefits of prayer are good, then certainly the placebo benefits of believing in God are stronger because it's a stronger placebo.
With the downside of you might find yourself at some point actually believing in God, right? Like there's a...
I'm sure you don't have a problem with that, Jake.
Well, there's a fun quote that I like to pull out from time to time from C.S. Lewis. I think it's in Mere Christianity, where he's talking about loving someone
yeah.
and someone who's hard to love, like the Buddhist who you record a podcast yeah, with yeah. who just rubs you up the wrong way every week, right?
Fucking dickhead.
You said it. No, but he says that if you act as though you love someone, then presently you'll come to find that you actually love them.
Well, right? I think this is a totally big tangent, but
please, let's tangent.
But yeah. So to me, though, that's very similar to, I think, the more traditional view of marriage, right? So I think the idea of marriage for love,
the, like, is non-romantic view.
Well, yeah, but I'm going to say the view that existed prior to the 1900s full stop.
100%. Right, yeah,
like,
yeah.
That, like, you know, that that the idea of marrying for love is such a modern concept, right? And absolutely. It's something we're obsessed with these days, but like it's so, so modern.
And even most people in the world right now don't marry for love.
Right, yeah. Like, and realistically, I mean, maybe First World War is when that started happening. Like after that, I don't even know.
Late 19th
Roaring century, 20s, I don't know. Yeah. But traditionally, marriage is an economic union, right?
Yep.
It is potentially a political alliance if you are wealthy enough to want to need that. But also it's an economic union. It's to say, well, you know, economically a household is better with multiple people involved. And so, obviously with the desire to propagate the race and children and that kind of stuff. And, you know, yeah. And historically, the view has always been in marriage that you marry for the main purpose of marriage, which is this is a good match. This is a good economic match. This is a good family match. This is a good structural, cultural,
societal benefits.
Societal benefits to it. And then you learn to love that person, and that actually through cohabiting with them and having sex with them and doing all these things that you will do in a marriage, that the love kind of comes later down the track.
And this is entirely anecdotal. I'm sure there's been research done into it. But there are definitely people who have had arranged marriages for whom that's just worked out so much better and more loving, we could say, than people who have married for love, partly which is the expectations that go into it, right? It's like I'm not necessarily going to feel affection for this person straight away, but here I am. This is what we're doing.
I also wonder whether that's also due to an expansive vision of what love is, right? So, I mean, if you're marrying for romantic love reasons, right, I would say that most of the time you're marrying for an emotion, right?
Sure.
You feel a certain emotion and you really, really want to hold on to that emotion, and you marry someone because they make you feel that emotion, right? Yeah, the emotion being love. I got news for you, at least from the Buddhist perspective, that nothing in life is permanent.
Well,
emotions will always change. And so if you are marrying somebody for a different reason, say an economic reason or a social reason, then the scope of emotions that you're willing to feel with that person are just wider, because the reason you're marrying them has nothing to do with those emotions. So whether you feel great about them or terrible about them, I'm sure there's obviously a limit, and there should be a limit.
Sure.
All love should be conditional. But there is a sense at which like that scope actually is expanded if you're connecting with someone for a different reason versus if you're connecting with someone purely to seek out and hold on to a particular type of emotion that you feel with that person.
So I'd be really curious as to listener reactions to what Jamal just said, because I think you are onto something. ChristianBuddhistBar@gmail.com, or as per the previous episode's invitation, you can send in an audio thing or whatever. We'll do a mailbag of people reacting to Jamal on marriage. Yeah. But because like I do think that you're onto something there, that I want to keep this feeling is not a good enough reason, I don't think, or not a that doesn't have enough depth, and if you're lucky, depth will kind of come along in that, and you'll get other bits. But that certainly I don't think, looking back on it, like my experience of getting married kind of wasn't just about that. It had other things going on as well, which I dare say kind of have acted as ballast.
Well, yeah, and this is not to say that I think all romantically driven marriages are like that, right? I'll make another controversial statement here, and listeners can write and tell me off about this one too. But I think the good romantic marriages, even if they are maybe initially...
There is no good or bad, but continue.
Sure.
Yep.
And who's the Christian, who's the Buddhist now? The romantic marriages that I think are more successful are the ones that, whilst they might have been instigated due to an emotional feeling or attachment, have also found other compatibility things that go along with that, right?
Totally.
It's not just about, oh, I really love this person, and so that's just enough. It's that actually our lives are compatible, our goals are compatible, how we deal with money is compatible.
And I think a whole bunch of I love this person, and therefore,
yeah,
yeah,
yeah. So I think it is a that emotion might be an indicator of good compatibility, but it's not inherently in itself the thing that can define whether or not a relationship is successful.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And there's a whole, we could go down this rabbit hole. But I want to bring us back to prayer, picking up on what you were saying before about, you know, all love should be conditional. We've talked about the...
Hashtag God's love.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right. We've talked about this before. But should all prayer be conditional then?
What would conditional prayer be?
It's a great question. Well, I mean, like the legend goes, and I'm not sure how much of this is like mythology or how much of this is fact, that Martin Luther winds up in a monastery because he's out riding his horse in a lightning storm or something like that, and prays to one of the saints, I think, saying, you know, save me from this lightning, and he's saved from the storm. And he'd made a vow, like, if you save me from this lightning, then I'll go and join your monastery. And so, well, he's kind of stuck in the monastery now, right? Because he made that promise. That's a conditional prayer.
I mean, that's we've done this before in the episode, but Yusuf Islam's conversion to Islam is around
absolutely.
That, right? Because, he was drowning and then, you know, prayed to God and said, if you save me from this, I'll dedicate my life to you. And then he kept up his end of the bargain.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, like, it's. I guess the whole concept of an exchange based, you know, deal being made in prayer is so foreign to me. I don't know. I don't have an answer to that. I mean, what do you think?
Well, because I think this kind of goes to, like, in some ways, an unconditionality of it. This is why the problem of what is God, how does God respond to prayers, is a real problem, right? Because especially if you're praying petitionary prayers, as Jackie Bailey describes them here, like, at what point do you give up on the petition? And, like, I'm kind of the view that part of that is God teaching us, training us to let go of particular things that, you know, we might be too attached to or what. Again, who's the Buddhist now? but also, like, kind of to... I guess, to what extent can God be trusted? Like, and does that matter for praying? And I'm guessing from the fact that you're saying, well, I can't really imagine a conditional prayer that suggests that, like, God ought to be trusted with prayer, or at least in your observation of religion, religious practice, that's kind of how it works.
Yeah, well, I guess, again, it's hard when I don't believe in a deity with which to make an exchange and condition with.
Sure.
Right, like that's kind of like...
I mean, you're welcome to take the placebo and pray and, report back to the class.
But,
yeah.
But like, that's kind of like, you know, yeah, I think in a Buddhist conception, like, yeah, there is no agency to divinity. So, you know, it's hard to have a condition. Yeah, it's hard to strike a deal with a non-agent.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, because kind of divinity is the universe and it's just there. Yeah. Which is why you can't really point prayers in its direction.
Right, exactly. Reminds me of a time a Christian Buddhist walked into a bar, actually.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. Was there a praying mantis at the bar? I short-circuited last week's joke.
Not this week. Oh, actually, you might enjoy this one.
Really?
So the Christian Buddhist walk into a bar and they go to the bar and the bartender's like... they hear this shouting coming from, like, the basement of the bar.
Sure.
And they're like, they go to the bartender, like, what's going on, right? And, like, there's this shouting. It's like, help, 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 someone help me. And the bartender's like, oh, it's the Calvinist again. Like, what do you mean the Calvinist? And it's like, well, there's a Calvinist who comes here, right?
Okay.
Earlier today he fell down the stairs. He fell down the stairs. He was walking to the toilets at the bottom and he fell down the stairs in the basement. And, like, he can get up and walk back up, but he refuses to do it. And he's just like, he's just shouting nonstop for help. And he's like, and they're like, oh, well, that's a bit weird. Like, do you know why? Like, what's going on? It's like, oh, yeah, because he's a Calvinist, right? So, you know, fallen people can't save themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. That's why the ambulance service is still in business. Yeah.
There you go. Yeah.
Do you have any other thoughts? Or that was disturbingly good.
Yeah, I'm just chuffed at how much you like that Calvinist joke. Yeah.
Do you have any other thoughts around prayer? Any reflections? Pray tell?
No, not really. I mean, like, I think I'll just to say that maybe, like, I sometimes, like, instinctively say prayer words just because cultural things will come up, but that I don't really believe it. I don't really actually. It doesn't mean anything to me.
What does that? I'm just going to pull this thread a little bit. Like, what does that look like to say prayer words? What kind of prayer words?
Oh, it's just that whole thing of, like, So, I mean, I think it's a Western cultural thing for me, but there's also a Chinese cultural thing where it's like, especially with gambling, if you're like, you know, you're like, you're going, oh, come on, yes, like, please, yep, please, yeah.
Because it's got that whole luck culture.
Yeah, so I think it's that. It's whenever there's like a luck element to something, that I'm like, oh, you know, like my brain will just automatically go, oh, no, please, come on. Yeah.
That's kind of like transactional in the sense of bargaining, right?
Oh,
like,
for sure. I don't believe it in the slightest. It's
yeah,
just
for
a,
sure.
It's
just it's
a knee-jerk reaction.
Yeah, what you do. Yeah.
How about you?
Do I pray while I'm gambling?
Well, no. Do you have any final thoughts?
Look, I just actually one last one on the article. Something I did really appreciate about this article. She talks about the Muslim practice listing the 99 attributes of Allah, a Hindu practice reciting the multiple names of God. The Tao Te Ching starts with the words, the unnameable is the eternally real, naming is the origin of all particular things.
Yeah.
And this idea that words matter, right? Like at the beginning of the Jewish inscription and Jewish and Christian scriptures, the God speaks and creation comes into being, right? Like in the Christ is called the Word of God. That's one of the descriptions. And that somehow this means that the words really matter and have some significance. And I mean, dare I say it, permanence, right? Like if words called creation into being. And so now I'm going off on my own little tangenty ramble, but I'm rereading Terry Pratchett's Discworld series. And one of the things that happens in that is that if you're a wizard saying a spell, as you speak it, the letters come and hover in like octarine purple around you and that kind of thing. And I wonder if there's something of that to prayer, like that just as you're speaking the words, that they have some kind of substance to them. And I guess that's a kind of Buddhist idea as well, in a way that kind of everything in reality affects every other little thing, and by thinking something or saying something, you're actually affecting something. I think you've told me something similar to this before about if someone is sick or dying and you say a particular, is it a metta or something like that, like that those words can actually have an effect.
But I think that's probably...
It's working in a completely different way. I appreciate that.
I think that's linked to the placebo effect, right?
Okay,
That's going on there. But also, I guess in Buddhist conceptions...
I think you had some theology around
that. Well, the theology is that there's vibrations, right?
Good vibrations.
Excitations, actually.
Correct.
But the theology there is that there are little vibrations going on...
excitations
with,
is a good word. Go on.
with the world, and that certain resonances and words, like it's the holy word Om, is supposedly got a particular resonance that actually helps imbue the world with peace or whatever else.
And that gives us a really excellent segue to the resonances with which we begin and end this show each week, which are by the wonderful Kevin MacLeod.
That's right. And you can add your resonance to the podcast at christianbuddhistbar@gmail.com. Shoot us a line.
You can. We're recording on Ngunnawal and Ngambri country. And on Ngunnawal and Ngambri country, you can walk into a bar with us.
It's true.
You can find that out on Facebook or email us.
First Friday of the month tends to be.
Yeah, usually. So I'll see you on Friday. May not actually be Friday when the week that this podcast goes out.